Okay, again, my name is Jess Jones. I'm a biologist with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm stationed here at Virginia Tech in the Department of Fish and Wildlife Conservation, and I serve as a faculty member, but my main job is to oversee and direct the Mussel Lab. The Freshwater Mollusk Conservation Center here at Virginia Tech, it's a cooperative research and propagation facility to restore and recover endangered mussels in Virginia and surrounding states. It's cooperative in the sense that, you know, I'm a federal scientist, I'm stationed here, the employees are Virginia Tech employees, graduate students and technicians, and we work with, you know, the state agencies, Virginia Department of Game and Fisheries, Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency, and then a lot of the surrounding field offices of the Fish and Wildlife Service. So we're always engaged in these partners and doing our work in a very cooperative way. So a short timeline on the establishment of the lab. Dick Neves founded the lab. He was the USGS scientist here for about 30 years, stationed in our department. Here he is posing in the Powell River as the green swamp monster. That's him in the Powell River helping us out doing some survey work. And so in 1994, Dick and his students started mussel propagation research at the Aquaculture Center, doing life history work, you know, working on the propagation and culture techniques. And as a result of that, in 1996, the first release in this country of an endangered freshwater mussel occurred in the Hoosier River. It was a small release of 52 individuals of the golden riffle shell. And then in 1998, there was a contract with Tennessee Wildlife Resources Agency to propagate mussels for Tennessee. And that really kind of started the ball rolling. And it allowed Dick and the lab to really, you know, begin this process of doing mussel propagation for restoration. And then in 2000, 2002, the main lab that we see today with the pond was constructed. And that was from a grant from National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and some other sources. And then, starting in 2004, the Fish and Wildlife Service contracts, the Natural Resource Damage Assessment and Restoration contracts on the Powell River and the Clinch River to restore freshwater mussels as part of spills that occurred on those rivers. So these are some of the main things that happened to kind of get the lab going. There's really four areas of research that we're involved in. You know, the heart of what we do is population restoration work. So looking, you know, working on the aspects of life history, you know, improving propagation and culture methods, working on broodstock management, and then ultimately the stocking of the mussels, stocking them in the rivers, and trying to build those populations back up. And related to that is population monitoring. So we do, you know, a lot of population monitoring at the sites that we're releasing mussels at, looking at survival and growth, trend analysis of both released individuals and the wild populations to see how they're doing, looking at aspects of their demography like recruitment rates, and then modeling some of these components to try to understand their population dynamics. We're also involved with ecotoxicology, doing assessments in the field and the laboratory of contaminants that may be acting as drivers for decline. So, you know, we have a number of projects right now, you know, assessing contaminants, you know, in some of the rivers that we work in. And then finally, conservation genetics. I do this work in collaboration with my colleague, Dr. Eric Callerman, here in our department. And this is, you know, there's the taxonomy of freshwater mussels is you know, poorly known. We look at aspects of the phylogenetics, how big groups are related to each other, the population genetics, how different populations of a species might be related to each other. And all this is important for us to try to manage the populations. And, you know, in recently looking at hatchery management and looking at those practices that would maintain genetic diversity over time as we propagate these mussels. So now I realize, you know, a lot of folks don't, you know, they're not familiar with mussels. They're ubiquitous in the rivers that we work, especially the ones that are very healthy. And just to provide a little bit of background, they're a bivalve mollusk. There's two shells to them, okay, like you would see a marine clam or something like that. They live in fresh water, primarily in rivers and streams, but also can live in lakes. They're long-lived animals. They can live 20, 30, 40, 50 years old. We've aged them in the Clinch River up to 80 years old. There's a species that we know of that's more than 100 years old, probably. The European pearl shell, for example, can live up to 200 years old. That really complicates a lot of what we do. They're filter feeders, so they filter the suspended material in the water column, but they also filter in the benthos, the deposited material in the benthos. And they use fish as a host. And the fish as a host uniquely defines freshwater mussels among bivalves worldwide. There's no other marine or freshwater bivalve that uses a fish as a host. And I'll talk about this at length here in just a second. And as a result of this, there's some very complex mimicry with freshwater mussels. Okay, so the freshwater mussel, it has to get its babies, its larvae, onto a fish, its host, okay? And the female mussel releases her larvae, her glaucidia, out into the river and gets down a fish host where the glaucidia attaches to the fish. It starts to metamorphose, and then it drops off the fish down into the river bottom to start growing into an adult. This process is actually quite complex. This is a picture of a glaucidium, pretty ferocious-looking creature, but that's about 200 to 300 microns in length, and it's designed to pierce the skin of a fish or the gill lamellae of a fish to start this metamorphosis process. So the question is how does this glaucidia of a mostly sessile organism attached to a mobile organism like a fish? And so to do this, they've evolved some really incredible host infection strategies. So one way they do this is by using mussel conglutinates. The kidney shell here produces a conglutinate that nearly perfectly mimics the larvae of the black fly, Simulidae. Each of these conglutinates contains about 200 to 300 glaucidia. The fluted kidney shell nearly perfectly mimics the pupae stage of the black fly. And then the endangered fan shell, an oligochaete and a worm, the dromedary, a leech-like structure. So very complex mimicry to attract their fish host. Another thing that they do is that the mantle tissue, that's that tissue that lays against the inside of the shell, it extends out and it can form a lure, okay? And so the endangered bird wing produces a mantle lure that mimics the pebble snail. It has little antennae and it grazes and moves around like it's grazing on algae. The rainbow mussel mimics crayfish. Those are pinchers and it will rock back and forth to mimic a crayfish. Wavy ray lamp mussel mimics a helgramite. And another morph here mimics a fish. You can even see the eye spot there and then the tail. Now, my favorite mussel is the oyster mussel. This is the female displaying on the bottom of the Clinch River. You can see the serrated teeth here. It attracts a fish to this colored area. And it acts as a Venus flytrap and captures the fish and infests it. And so what happens is these micro lures are used to bring in a darter host. It comes in, thinks it's getting a meal, captures it, and infests the fish host. So you can see, a little bit hard to see, but this is the tail of a darter sticking out at the end of this mussel, and it's infesting it, and it's releasing the fish here. The whole side of the fish is peppered with glaucidia. This pad here is designed to swell up with water and cradle the fish to reduce the stress as it's struggling, as it's being infested. Okay, so I'm going to show a little bit of a video here of a related mussel. Can you help me here? Gotcha, thanks. So this is a related mussel to the one I just showed you. The fish is going to be moving in here from the right. These are videos from a colleague of mine, Chris Barnhart, Missouri. So it's attracting a fish, so it's moving a little bit. It's got, you know, an insect lure in there, and the fish is coming in from the right, and boom, it catches it on its snout like that. But there's more to it than that. The fish will be stressed out, you know, it's going to try and struggle and get away, and then the mussel is just laying there, okay, you know, waiting for the fish to kind of calm down. And then once it's got it calmed down, it will have this bellowing motion. Now it's starting to pump its larvae into the buccal cavity of the fish. And you can see the glaucidia spilling out by the hundreds. And then once it's done, it lets it go. So who would have ever thought, you know, that mussels are doing these things in the bottom of our rivers? Freshwater mussels also perform very important ecosystem functions. They're burrowers, kind of like earthworms. They're constantly moving, the sediment of the river bottom. They deposit, fecal material and other material in the river bottom to help, increase productivity. They're constantly filtering. Because mussels can reach a very large abundance at some of these sites, they serve as a tremendous food base for a range of animals, fish and, other mammals. They serve as habitat, the shell, the aquatic insects and fish will spawn in the in the shell. And generally, they've been shown to increase the productivity of the stream bottom. So when you have these healthy, mussel sites, they're more productive streams. And so the freshwater mussel, these are the siphons. And for a big mussel, they can siphon, or process 1 to 2 gallons of water an hour. Okay, some of them even more than that. And so just to demonstrate this, the tank on the left has no mussels in it. The tank on the right has 5 mussels in it. We stirred the tanks up, and then we photographed the tanks over time. And so you can see the mussels starting to clear the one tank. Then after about 30 minutes to an hour, they clear the entire tank. So the filtering capacity of freshwater mussels is very tremendous. So, why do we need mussel propagation? Mussels are the most endangered group of animals in the United States. Approximately 70% of the fauna is listed at some level. Endangered, state endangered, or at some level. We need this to alleviate risks associated with small population size, environmental threats, increased population abundance and distribution, especially for these critically endangered species. And because our rivers are so hemmed in by dams, the fish, they can't colonize these areas naturally anymore. So we are now, the agents of colonization in terms of moving these mussels to areas that they formerly inhabited. And then ultimately, we need this to be able to create enough viable populations to minimize extinction risk and ultimately aid in their recovery. So the propagation process starts by first extracting the glaucidia from the female mussel. We do this using a non-lethal method. We use a water-filled hypodermic syringe. We flush it out. Then we return the females to the point of collection. And we've collected female mussels alive and gravid in subsequent years by doing this. Then we take those larvae and we stick them in a container with the fish. And we'll infest, 30 to 40, 50 fish, depending on the species, for maybe like an hour. And then the fish are excited. They're breathing in the larvae. They're getting attached. And then you'll see these larvae here attached onto the gill lamellae of this fish. And so they're starting to embed and cyst into the gill filaments. And this starts an encapsulation process. So the gill tissue is starting to migrate over top of the glaucidia. And this happens actually pretty quickly. Within hours, by the end of the day, they're fully encysted. So once the fish are infested, we hold them in these tanks that have temperature control, filtration. We spend a lot of time on the captive care of fish because we can't afford to lose the fish in captivity because it cuts into the productivity of what we're trying to do. So a lot of what we do is, working on methods for captive care of fish. So once the juveniles drop off, they go to the tank bottom. And when they drop off, they're about the same size. They're a few hundred microns, about 1/4 of a millimeter in size. But they are very energetically, active. You can see this mussel filtering all this particulate matter. So we have to have food, delivered to these animals on a regular basis. They can't go not being fed like a fish. They have to constantly be eating, or they will starve to death relatively quickly. So we'll put them in some kind of container, with a recirculating system to start the culturing process. And we'll try and culture them for like 1 to 2 years, try to get them up to about 20 to 30 millimeters to a point where we can start tagging them. We don't want to hold them in the lab for too long. We've looked at a number of factors, done research on diet, substrate, controlling predators like flatworms, maintaining water quality, system design, aspects of species life history, and then the quality of the larvae. These are all areas that we've done research on at the lab to try to improve the overall process. So once we get the mussels up to size, this 20, 30 millimeter size, we'll tag them. This is the endangered purple bean. You can see the tags here. and then we'll bag them up. You know, these are all mussels from a release a couple years ago that we bagged up, and we take them down to the river and start releasing them. And what we do is we just go to these sites that we know are good sites, and we just start, you know, spreading the mussels around, broadcasting them out. And they're burrowers. This is what they naturally do. And within 10, 15, 20 minutes, they start burrowing down into the substrate. And after an hour or two, most of them are burrowed down. So from 1996 to 2016, we have worked with 31 species at the lab. We have produced 2.5 million mussels. We've released 19 of these species. We've released over 600,000 mussels at more than a dozen sites in the Upper Tennessee River Basin, including 13 federally listed taxa. And let me just show you one thing. If you notice here, this is the endangered oyster mussel. We produced over a million of those guys. And we've released a lot of them, okay, at different ages. We know a lot about this species, okay? We've learned a lot about it. We know the fish host. We know how to propagate and culture it. But other species, like this one, the monkey face, this endangered monkey face, we produced one of those guys. And we've released zero. And you can see some zeros here. So their mussels are like, you know, the difference between a bald eagle and a hummingbird, for example. They're both birds, but they're very different. And mussels are the same way. You know, the species that we work with have very different life histories, and some are very difficult to work with, and some are easier to work with than others. And then as an example, restoration of the endangered oyster mussel, we've released over 300,000 of these guys. We've established four new major populations. There was one major population. We've now established four more. 12 sites have been stocked. The survival and growth at sites has been good. And at one of our sites, we're already observing recruitment from animals that have been stocked at that site. We're monitoring these animals. Again, this is a pit tag approach. These are pit tags, and we can use that pit tag reader to find the mussels down in the substrate and record the survival and growth for that, you know, particular individual. But we use a range of methodologies. So generally speaking, you know, over this last 20 years, the lab has been involved in improving propagation and culture technology. We've worked to restore multiple populations of endangered mussels. We've worked to develop monitoring techniques. And there's a lot of spin-off benefits for aquatic toxicology. We're now involved in, you know, propagating the mussels so they can be used in a laboratory setting to test, you know, various contaminants like trace metals or organic contaminants and see how those are acting as drivers for the wild population. And then finally, the overall approach of mussel propagation, stocking, and restoration, I feel it's a proven method now. While there's plenty of work to be done on other species, and those are, you know, more difficult species, the overall approach is shown to be effective. And so I think that, you know, moving forward, this is something that you'll see a lot more of, not just in the, you know, university facilities. This is one of the few university facilities, but at the state hatcheries around the country. So because of this technology being pretty effective. And with that, I thank you for your time. And if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.